Let's Talk Development, Season 3, Episode 6.
At CDPR, we are delighted to be having this conversation with Professor Aisha Jalal. Most of you know Aisha Jalal. She's a Mary Richardson Professor of History at Tufts University, one of the most eminent historians of Pakistan, indeed South Asia, if not global, a well-known public intellectual, huge body of work she has done. I've read three of Aisha Jalal's books, and I'm looking forward to reading the fourth, which just came out. There was a book launch just at the Lahore Literary Festival. Aisha has, in addition to, of course, Tufts University, she has taught at Harvard. She's taught at Wisconsin. She has taught at Columbia. And she's taught at LUMS.
That's right.
So we are delighted to be hosting Aisha. She also has a Sitara Imtiaz from the government of Pakistan. Aisha, let me start off with a question. Just getting a historian's perspective on the macroeconomic mess that Pakistan is in. Let me just break it down into what that is. Basically, economists look at the mess from a very macro accounting angle, that the government spends far more than it gets in revenue. That results in current account deficits. That results in balance of payments crises. And we've been having these very frequently in the last 20 years. And we find ourselves embedded there, despite the fact that others in South Asia have come out of it. India came out of it in the late 90s and has been on a fairly stable trajectory since then. Bangladesh came out of it fairly early as well and had very good growth outcomes. Pakistan, not so much. It would be great to get some sense from you as to how historians think about the mess Pakistan is in, so that we can go beyond just the accounting numbers as economists do.
Well, I mean, let me first say that economists tend to over-emphasize their own profession. And I think that a lot of the problems in Pakistan's economy, I mean, some are structural, which I'll come to, but some are political decisions that were taken given the structural realities of Pakistan. And if I recall correctly, in my earlier work, I pointed out that when Pakistan was created out of India's northeastern and northwestern extremities, it inherited some 17-odd% of the total assets of undivided India, and 33% and a bit more percent of the armed forces. So there was always an imbalance between the resource endowment and the military and the security dimension. So, I mean, this was something that the chiefs of Joint Chiefs of Staff, the British Joint Chiefs of Staff, warned that the joint defense of Pakistan, which would have only 17% of the assets of undivided India, would cost the same as that for the whole of India. So there was always an imbalance there. And it was that structural fault line on which Pakistan was built that led to center region issues, or rather compounded the problems of center region, because as we all know, the Muslim League was not very well organized in the parts of those provinces that became part of Pakistan. So given that, I do think that the security fear that Pakistan may well collapse, I mean, it was supposed to collapse in 6 months, which is why I always say that the big question is not whether Pakistan can survive, but how it has survived. And how it has survived, we all know, is that very early on, the dominance of the army in particular and the military establishment came to the fore. I would say as early as 53, if not earlier. Some might say 51, with the assassination of Pakistan's first Prime Minister, Liaquat Ali Khan. Once Pakistan started reaching out to the centers of international capitalism, notably Washington, something that it had tried really immediately after its creation in 49, because Pakistan simply ran out of money. And its monthly military expenditure was far out, out of proportion from its revenues. So they were already asking the United States for help. The Brits had none, because they had won the war, supposedly, but it was a Pyrrhic victory because they had become indebted to the United States. And if I'm not correct, they've only just a few years ago paid off their World War I debt and still need to pay their World War II debt. So Americans were not interested. They were interested in Greece. They were doing the Marshall Plan. But the outbreak of the Korean War changed yes. everything and gave yes. Pakistan the opportunity. The Brits tried very hard to explain to the Americans that there would be problems if India did not come on board. But India didn't want to under Nehru. But Pakistan did, because Pakistan wanted to raise a viable shield of defense against India, whereas the Americans wanted Pakistan to contain communism. So there are people who argue that this was a delusion, and I don't think it was a delusion at all. They recognized that they were at odds in what they expected of each other, and that's what happens in international relations. So once Pakistan entered what is frequently referred to as Pactomania, joined CETO, CENTO, the internal balance tilted further. I mean, as it was, the political party was not that well represented in the areas that became part of Pakistan. The split between East and West, I won't go into that, which created its own problems. So a combination of factors led to a military dominance and eventually take over in 58. And after that, Pakistan's projection of itself as a rentier state has made all kinds of problems, which economists can do a better job explaining than me. One of them was that once money was flowing in, Pakistan is, if you do your homework, you'll see that most flows that have come in, large flows, have coincided, interestingly enough, with military rule.
Yes.
So why is that? I think that we need to investigate, and that's the rentier issue, which led to, in my view, a refusal to take politically awkward decisions like expanding the tax base.
Yes.
Now you can say that about India as well, but India is huge, and India's defense requirements have never cost, as much as Pakistan, just given our size.
1% of GDP that India spends
on
defense
costs us much more.
Results in exactly. a lot more than our 1%.
So I think yes. that is the fundamental problem, yeah. which has really been. But then, of course, decisions have been made,
yes.
Decisions of expediency, and then the internal jockeying for position, the political change, and Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's period, which was, as you know, geared towards a left-leaning populism, where he wanted to bring about redistributive change following the long decade with Ayub Khan.
So, Asha, if I may, the structural problem that you have identified, which is, a political party that didn't really have deep moorings in
That's right.
what became Pakistan, and a military establishment which was of substantial size, etc., that it required resources that weren't there, and therefore it resulted in a relationship with the United States, especially as to contain communism, which resulted in a lot of external funding coming into
That's
Pakistan.
Right.
That seems to have set a pattern.
Yes.
Which manifests itself in terms of how the economy shapes up.
Yes.
Pakistan, the initial external largesse that came to Pakistan actually was invested sensibly. We created the infrastructure, we expanded the infrastructure, and we began industrialization, but industrialization that resulted in very good export performance. It was internationally competitive industrialization. And Pakistan was, in fact, right up to the 2000s, a country, South Asian country, with the highest export to GDP ratio. This has changed since then, and we are now the least export to GDP ratio in South Asia. And I don't see an awakening in the political leadership to this fact, that this will make us more and more dependent on external assistance rather than stand on our own feet. I want to draw your attention now to a historical dimension of this issue. The areas that now constitute Pakistan were actually on the trading routes. So international trade is not new to the communities that now constitute Pakistan. Peshawar, Lahore, Upper Sindh were on these vast trading routes that connected markets to the east with markets to the west. And these areas benefited from it. And I've recently read Mark Noyer's book on Indus Valley Civilization, and he traces seals which show a trade pattern in which Indus Valley, the large cities in Indus Valley period, Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, they were importing raw materials from areas further to the west and the north, yes, and exporting finished goods.
Well, which is why I was going to bring in the politics again for you. I mean, I agree that when you look at macro figures, this is what you see, trade flows, lots of opportunities, things are going well. But once, what the sort of industrial infrastructure that you talk about that was created in the initial decades did was to create a very warped balance. I mean, it sort of led to the enrichment of a handful of families, and that was sought to be corrected after the 1970 elections with some redistributive measures. They didn't go far enough, but what that did do was to destroy business confidence. And instead of investing in productive enterprises, they started engaging in trade. Yeah. And taking their capital out. So I do think that that uncertainty that was created has to be factored in to what happened subsequently. But unfortunately, we've not really faced that problem directly. Instead, we've always had opportunities internationally where Pakistan could once again, I mean, if you take the Zia-ul-Haq period, you'll see that Zia was almost an international pariah. But at the moment the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, everything changed. Yeah. And that again brought in massive flows of greenbacks, which the Saudi Arabian government backed dollar to dollar.
Right.
So then again, that was easy money. And so I think Pakistanis have developed I'm not saying all Pakistanis, but a good number. There is this ethos of the work ethos is that you know, you don't have to work too hard to do things. Right. Things should come easy. And if you work too hard, you're a fool.
Right.
So I think that's basically the ethos. Yeah.
So in one sense, people often talk about Pakistan not having enough foreign exchange, not having enough dollars, etc. And therefore, there is this continuous struggle by political leaders to go and seek money, find money from wherever they can. The reality is that Pakistan is awash with dollars. With $38 billion of remittances coming in.
Yes, but you have a problem where the dollars go is the issue.
So that's what I'm coming to. So it's not that enough dollars are not being generated. Pakistani workers are generating all the dollars you want. We are not building a consensus in the political leadership across the divide.
Yes.
And what to do with that money, which puts Pakistan on its own feet. Now, I want you to relate this to the structural problem that you have identified.
Of course. I mean, the point is that political party polarization, which became greater over the years, the political parties recognized the dominance of the military and found it more fruitful to ally with the military rather than with each other in order to bring about a shift in civil-military relations. So that is the pattern now. I mean, if you look at the current debate, it's not about civilian supremacy, even though some would like to pretend that it is. It's about getting back into power.
Yes.
So I think that has been, I mean, so now the civil-military relationship is not just one where it's the civil versus the military, but they've formed a relationship. And that has become the reality. I don't see that changing unless political parties have a change of heart, which just doesn't seem likely in the near future.
Right. But again, going back to the Sole Spokesman, chapters of Sole Spokesman, you point out very clearly the politics of Sindh, the politics of Punjab, and the politics of what was then the frontier province, and indeed Bengal, was not one that would that would promote the kind of federal structure that we had to deal with eventually, in the sense that when one looks at fractured decision making at the highest levels, it reflects the fact that a political party has a majority in one province, another party has a majority in a second province, and there are very few parties, very few episodes in the last 30 years when we've had parties which cut across the country and can be thought of as national parties. To have any kind of consensus on the change in terms of how you structure the economy, you need a party political structure which allows this federation to have that country. That hasn't come about.
Well, naturally, it can't come about if there are political parties that find it more conducive to their own good fortune to ally with the military establishment or the army, if you prefer. So rather than agreeing amongst themselves, so as a result, provincial devolution of financial powers is current. I mean, we know that the NFC award is currently under target. And yes, I think it may well be the case that the Federation, or rather the center, the federal center, has been left ill-equipped to pay its enormous debts. So that, you know, that sort of tension between the balance between the federation, which requires an arrangement between the center and the different regions, is an adversarial one. But let me just also point out that the idea of the federation, I mean, the British created a unified state, if I can emphasize that enough. But the idea of the federation was one that was adopted as the future. And it was the failure of federalism in India that led to partition.
Yes.
But I do want to emphasize that before the idea of a modern state, a monolithic sovereignty of the kind the British tried to project came about, I mean, in the early modern period, as you know, I mean, there was an inbuilt federalism simply for technological reasons. The center simply couldn't exercise that kind of power all the way. I mean, from if you're in Delhi, they couldn't exercise it all the way to in Sindh, perhaps. And so there was an inbuilt freedom. So I think that has been a problem, that it has proven easier for the rulers, the managers of the Pakistani state, to persist with the old colonial unified state, rather than to really live up to the promises made of a federal structure.
Right.
So I think that has happened to some extent in India as well. But there was a party,
yes,
which you've just explained, yes, had a spread of support, at
yes,
least in the initial decades.
Yes.
Subsequently, we've seen India also has had problems and is continuing to have problems. And
yes,
whether how well they succeed with their Hindu Rashtra projection remains to be seen. We historians tend to think that it is well nigh impossible for this to work in the long run, because of the regional dimension is so deeply embedded. So, same here.
Right.
So I think that is basically the problem. And the
right,
the fact that we then on top of it, we go ahead and lose the Eastern Wing, which contains the majority of the population, has only added a new dimension to the securitized view of Pakistan, which again sort of suffocates politics. And even those favored parties recognize that they are better off dealing with. I mean, you know, you people talk about popularity, but here it's acceptability. So, I mean, no party can take power without the approval of the military establishment.
Right. So in the Lahore Literary Festival, there was a session on poverty and trade in South Asia. I was on the panel.
I see.
And one question that was put to us was by the moderator was who's thinking about South Asia region? Are there people who think regionally? And your book came to my mind immediately, The Sole Spokesman, and I immediately felt that the only person who, with the stature, who thought regionally about South Asia was Jinnah.
He was a visionary, which is why we call him a visionary, constitutional visionary, who realized that who recognized the trends. And he was a very well-versed person. You may remember that I gave a series of lectures at your behest at LUMS, That gave me an opportunity to dwell particularly into Muhammad Ali Jinnah's role at the time of the roundtable conferences. It's really fascinating that he attended the second roundtable conference and only sort of sought a presence on one committee, the Federal Structures Committee, whereas Gandhi sat on all committees. And if you read the text of that, I mean, he was quoting from he was referring to the Canadian Federation, the American Federation. Yes. So the man was extremely well versed in constitutional law, and I think he was right. And I mean, we may not be ready to acknowledge that yet, but I think time will tell that he had the perfect vision. He knew what was required here.
Right. So we've created institutions such as SARC, and then they were systematically undermined. Unfortunately, I don't see any leader in South Asia which is thinking in terms of the region, which is particularly worrying now that the global environment is changing in a very dramatic way. It's not going to be Pax Americana anymore, which means that we will have to start thinking for ourselves, thinking about regional security ourselves.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is happening at a time when the possibility of any kind of rapprochement with India is well nigh impossible.
Yes,
there is a government there that believes that Pakistan is irrelevant. It was a mistake to begin with. It's a failure. And what is more, it's irrelevant. Now, with that kind of attitude, you know, you can't possibly think about South Asia.
But Aisha, wouldn't you think that if you had that view of the region, it would be even more important to have good relations with Pakistanis, if not with Pakistan.
Well, I mean, I think it sort of works hand in glove. I mean, you know,
sure.
Even if they are going to make a concession to Pakistanis. But I think the two states have really been intent upon preventing a real understanding between the people.
Yes.
I mean, the sort of, they seem to really exist to prevent the people from interacting with each other.
Yes, yes.
But we do, let me just sort of just
sure.
say that we do think of South Asia. I mean, we continue to. I mean, one of my next projects is actually on the 17th. We did a conference, a joint Harvard-Tufts conference on the question of nation partition federation. So that's the next project that I'm working
okay.
on. It's a
okay.
set of very creative essays that you might enjoy reading.
Right. A little bit on how history is taught.
Oh, yes.
If history, I remember it was a bit of a struggle. I was then dean of social
That's
sciences
right.
at LUMS, and we tried very hard at the time to have a department of history here. Eventually, we succeeded, but it took a lot of discussion and pointing out that where we are sitting has a massive. A expanse of history
That's right.
within a day's journey,
True.
You know, 5,000 years to Harappa and 2,500 years to Taxila, 1,000 years to Multan, and everything else is in Lahore. And yet we have not, you know, gone deeply enough in that pool of knowledge, that pool of inheritance.
That's right.
To define our identity and create a future.
You know, it's not unusual for newly created states, as I discovered when I visited Central Asia soon after their independence, realizing that they were doing exactly what we had done, i.e., preferring an official narrative of nationalism over the historical realities, which sometimes are a bit more awkward. In Pakistan's case, I've always said that ideology was preferred over history and over a period of time. But I mean, I remember I certainly read history in class 6 and 7, but it was really in the 80s that history as a discipline was stopped in favor of a full-fledged Pakistan studies. I mean, history is a discipline. People just think that history is about the past, it's about names, it's about dates. History is a constant dialogue with the present.
Yes.
And that, I think, is where we
yes.
are. We fail to understand how our past is so important. And that's what I'm kind of doing here. You know, we have a notion of time in my new book, which is very much a European Eurocentric one, which is that it's linear serial time. And so we're constantly we're supposed to be catching up with Europe rather than remaining true to our own past. Yes. So there are many people who believe that the best has already passed. So we either return to the Islamic glory of Islam in the 7th century, or we have nowhere to go. So I do think all those, our sense of history is rather warped. It would be, and I think that Lums has done a very good job. Now you have a core of people teaching that. So I hope that that will eventually begin to have an impact. But it's a long haul.
Yes. And I really think that if we are to be, to find a place for ourselves within the South Asian tradition, we will need to equip ourselves with our history.
Absolutely.
Because then we will be on the path that you speak of, which is our own path as opposed to somebody else's
path. But there are lots of obstacles in the way, including language. Look at our educational system. I'm not again talking about Lums, even though I do think that students here very proudly tell me that they don't read Urdu,
yes.
Which I find amazing. But there is a problem that after 16 years of teaching English, our students are unable to speak correctly. They don't speak Urdu very well. Maybe they can speak Punjabi, but they can't write it either. So we have this cognitive dissonance with this linguistic ability to express ourselves. That will remain for a bit unless we can sort out the language.
But Aisha, that hasn't bothered India.
Well, because they have kept regional languages and they've kept English. I mean, basically English has been, I'm not saying that all Indians write extremely well, but India had so many more institutions than we did.
Yes.
So it was a little more difficult to destroy, even though I think it may well happen in the years to come.
Yes.
But we had a few institutions that it was easier to destroy.
Yes.
The other thing that I always feel we need to understand is that whether as a result of colonial rule or even earlier, we haven't really understood the difference between private and public. Private good and public weal. People here really are really there for themselves, and the idea of giving to the people. I think the youth have that sensibility, but I'm afraid our ruling elite hasn't really lived up to that.
Is that more so in Pakistan than in other South Asian countries?
Perhaps not, but given the fact that they do have formal democracies and we don't even have that, has created a much greater credibility, legitimacy crisis in Pakistan where people don't really feel that these governments truly represent them. And that suspicion is very strong here.
Aisha, when will we see you back at Lums teaching again?
That's a very good question. I would love to come, but I'm hoping that once the doctoral program gets underway, I would like to return.
Okay.
Because I think you have very competent young historians here. I'm not needed, but for doctoral programming, I could come and help a little bit.
Aisha, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's been
delightful
to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
Please subscribe so you never miss a podcast and comment below who you would like to see next.